Rapp thought he heard the clank of a slide locking in the open position, but he wasn't sure. A split second later, he heard the heavy footsteps of someone running. That was it. He was either reloading or out. Rapp drew the silenced Beretta from under his right arm and bolted between the two parked cars to his left. He stayed low, glancing over the roofs of the cars. He caught a glimpse of the Libyan as he took a left turn at the next corner. That put a smile on Rapp's face. "Run all you want," he thought. "The more distance we can put between us and those 10 muzzle blasts, the better." Rapp rounded the corner wide and fast, trying to keep the parked cars between himself and Ismail. They were on the left bank, or Rive Gauche, and Ismail was headed toward the Rhone. They had just turned off a street that was purely residential and onto one that was a mix of retail and apartments. The shops were all closed, and fortunately the sidewalk was deserted. Rapp stayed in the street and broke into a full sprint. Geneva, because it was wedged between two mountain ranges on one end and a lake on the other, was even more cramped than your standard European city. The streets were barely wide enough for two small cars to pass. An American SUV was out of the question. Ismail was a good 100 feet in front of him, not an easy shot standing still, let alone running and aiming at a moving target. Rapp kept the pistol at his side. Long black coat, black pants, black shoes, and a black gun. Black on black. Nothing to see. He was gaining on Ismail with every stride, staying low, the top of his head just barely visible over the roofs of the vehicles. And then Ismail saw him as Rapp passed from one car to the next. There was now no more than 70 feet of separation, just over 20 yards. Either the man was really slow, or Rapp was really fast, or probably both. 60 feet in closing was the best Rapp could figure when they locked eyes. Rapp started to raise his pistol to fire, but before he had it leveled, Ismail was swinging the bag around, and then all hell broke loose. The bag exploded, spitting red-orange flashes on the dark street. Rapp turtled, dropping behind a nice piece of German steel. Counting shots was not an option with whatever it was in the overnight bag. The rate of fire told Rapp that it was probably an Uzi or a MAC-10. To the uninitiated, a gun was a gun, but in his new line of work, caliber was every bit as important as rate of fire. Since the Mercedes had no problem stopping the rounds, Rapp concluded it was a 9mm Uzi. If it had been the MAC-10, he would have felt the punch of the .45-caliber rounds as they penetrated the body and rattled around the interior of the car. Rapp glanced at his watch as glass rained down on him from the blown-out windows. He could picture in his mind's eye the Libyan backing up as he laid down fire. The Uzi he was firing used either 20, 32, or 40-round magazines. The 40 was unlikely because it probably wouldn't fit in the bag. And if it was 20, he would be done already, so that meant it was 32 rounds and he was almost out. And once Rapp heard the click, it would be over. There was no way the guy could pull a weapon like that out of a bag and reload it before Rapp was on him. The bullets stopped, the noise replaced by a half-dozen car alarms that were now chirping and beeping and screeching and flashing. Rapp came up with his weapon this time, his finger on the trigger, ready to fire. Ismail was gone. Rapp caught a glimpse of him farther down the block and tore off, again staying in the street so he could use the cars for cover. The clock in his head was marking time as he pressed his advantage. He closed again to within 60 feet. Ismail looked over his shoulder, raised the bag, and let loose another burst. Rapp went into a crouch behind a car but kept moving. Rapp couldn't be sure if it was a 4- or 5-round burst, but it had stopped, and Ismail was on the run again. Rapp, thinking the gun was out of bullets, or close to being out, ran tall now, more worried about speed than cover. Ismail made it to the corner and turned left. Rapp stayed wide again, and when he cleared the corner, he came upon the unwelcome sight of Ismail standing there with his left arm wrenched around a woman's throat. Rapp didn't look at her. He didn't want to look at her. Old, young, fat, skinny, none of it mattered. Ismail's right hand was still in the duffel bag, gripping the Uzi, which might or might not be out of bullets. Ismail started screaming at him to drop his weapon or he would kill the woman. Rapp continued to close, as he had been taught. His pistol was up, directly in front of his face, an extension of his left eye, which was attached to his brain, which was still counting the seconds and telling him to finish this and get the hell out of there. The woman was now screaming, and for the first time Rapp noticed she had a small dog on a leash that was yipping and snapping at Ismail's legs. He had no doubt that Ismail would kill the woman, but what purpose would it serve? If Ismail had any bullets left in that gun, he would turn it on Rapp right now and zip him with a nice burst to the chest. If he shot the woman, he was a dead man, and he didn't want to die, as he had proven very loudly over the last half minute. His only way out of this was to kill the man who had been chasing him. He was nicely shielded by the woman. All he had to do was swing the bag around and unload. Rapp stopped at 20 feet and decided that since Ismail hadn't taken aim at his chest, he was bluffing. In the end, it was the dog that tilted things in Rapp's favor. Ismail wisely tried to create some distance between them by stepping back. What he didn't know, because he hadn't bothered to look down, was that the little yipping dog had run a couple of circles around them, and his leash had formed a nice little lasso around the Libyan's ankles. Ismail stumbled and jerked to his left to catch himself. For a brief second, the side of his head was clearly visible. Rapp was now only 20 feet away. He squeezed the trigger once, and that was all it took. Chapter 46. Beirut, Lebanon. Hurley stepped onto the roof, a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand, his thoughts already traveling back in time. The hotel was in a neighborhood called Burj Hamoud. It was controlled by the Armenians, which was why Hurley had decided to stay here for the night. The Armenians were one of the few factions that had managed to stay neutral during the Civil War. There had been a few shots fired between the Armenians and their Maronite neighbors, but no major battles. It had been a strange day, the meeting with Kennedy, the briefing with Rapp before sending him off, and the analysis of the intercepts. There was nothing like stealing a man's fortune to get him riled up. Voices they hadn't tracked in years had popped up. Beirut was going to be a very target-rich environment. Before they could leave, though, they had to look the part. He dragged Richards to one of Zurich's second-hand clothing stores, where they purchased some ill-fitting suits and dress shirts, well-worn shoes, and some beat-up luggage. Hurley added some gray to his hair, and both men skipped shaving. They boarded a flight for Paris and then on to Beirut, just two men in a sea of travelers. They arrived as the sun was setting on the far end of the Mediterranean, feeling a mix of anticipation, anger, and apprehension. That's what Beirut did to Hurley. He'd spent time in the city before the Civil War, back when it was a thriving Mecca of Christians and Muslims living side by side, socializing, raising families, enjoying life, and for the most part getting along. Then the PLO began to radicalize the slums and demand a say in how things were run. The Maronites had no intention of sharing rule with these gypsies, and the battle lines were drawn. No one, not even Hurley, had thought the disagreement so egregious that it would plunge the city into a 15-year civil war, but it did. More than 1 million had fled, 250,000 were killed, hundreds of thousands of people were wounded and crippled, and the economy and much of central Beirut were laid to waste. That such a great city could be so thoroughly destroyed was enough to shake the faith of even the most optimistic. At the airport there were a few signs that things were headed in the right direction. The part of the terminal that had been severely damaged during the Israeli shelling of 1982 was now torn down, and reconstruction was underway. Hurley and Richards trudged down the metal stairs with their fellow passengers. Tired and bored Lebanese militiamen flanked the travelers and directed them toward immigration and customs. The last time Hurley had been here, immigration and customs consisted of a single portly bureaucrat sitting behind a metal desk on the tarmac. His job had been less about border security than about collecting the bribes needed to enter the country. Now they filed into the airport, where there were poster boards announcing ambitious rebuilding plans. They threaded through the customs lines, trying their best to look tired and bored. Richards passed with barely a glance. He handed over his cash that they called a fee, but was more of a bribe, because it never saw its way into the treasury. Hurley had to answer a few questions from the customs official, but nothing that was too alarming. He thought he caught one of the supervisors standing behind the three customs agents, paying him a little too much attention. But that, after all, was his job. In the end, it was nothing to worry about. The man didn't intervene or follow them to baggage claim. They collected their luggage and stood in line once again. This time they were both searched. Then, outside at the cab stand, Hurley slipped the man a $20 bill and told him in Arabic that he wanted to pick his own cab. For no reason other than the fact that it was random, Hurley chose the fourth cab in line. They took it to the under-renovation Intercontinental Hotel, where they went inside and bought a drink. This was also where Hurley persuaded the bartender to sell him the bottle of Jack Daniels. From there, they found another cab, skirted the central business district, and had the man drop them off 3 blocks from the Mar Yusuf Inn. Hurley would have preferred to have had the safe house ready, but there was no getting around it. Not if he wanted to use someone he could absolutely trust. Besides, there was only so much he could control. Setting up a new base of operations was never easy, and was even more difficult in a town like this, with shifting battle lines. Hurley looked out across the skyline. He couldn't swear, but there seemed to be quite a few more lights than there had been a few years earlier. Perhaps progress was being made. He heard some voices and stepped around the top of the blockhouse that encased the stairs. A few of the hotel workers were clustered around a folding table, sitting in plastic chairs. They waved to Hurley. He flashed them a smile and walked to the far edge. Beirut was like most densely packed cities, in that the inhabitants used roofs to try to escape the claustrophobic feeling of being shut in. There was another plastic chair in the corner where he was standing, but he didn't feel like sitting. He looked north, over the rooftops, at the ocean. Way out there, on the horizon, to the northwest, he could make out the glow of the lights on Cyprus. Back to the south, the airport was lit up, receiving its last few flights for the day. A not-so-welcome memory started to bubble up. Hurley gripped the bottle tightly, held it to his lips, and took a swig of Jack with the hope that he could drown it out. After a minute, he started up a heater and tried to remember the last time he'd been in the city. He wasn't counting his last trip 2 years earlier, as he had been in and out in less than a day, hardly enough time to look up any of his old contacts. The city brought back so many memories. A few good, a lot bad. He took another swig, but it didn't work this time. His gaze was drawn to the west, where the old embassy had stood. He'd been here that day, here being the Burj Hamoud district. Hurley had met one of his contacts for coffee that morning, a man named Levon Petrosyan, the Armenian crime boss who kept things working during the Civil War. In addition to making sure the neighborhood had power, water, and food, Petrosyan handled all of the gambling and prostitution and, of course, collected a pretty penny in protection money. After their meeting, Hurley decided to take the crazy Armenian up on his offer to sample some of the merchandise. Hurley had been in bed with 2 women from the Armenian highlands of eastern Turkey when the explosion rocked the room. His worst fears were realized when he'd scrambled onto the roof, still pulling on his pants. Bombs were becoming increasingly common back in 1983, but this one was much bigger than the average mortar round or RPG. The plume of debris and smoke was close enough to the embassy that Hurley was certain it had been the target. The only question was the amount of damage done. Hurley raced back to the bedroom to collect the rest of his stuff, and then down to the street, where his driver was asleep behind the wheel of the company jeep. Hurley bumped him out of the driver's seat, started the jeep, and tore off down the street. When he arrived and looked up at the 7-story building, his heart was in his throat. The front entrance was gone, a gaping hole from the 7th floor all the way to the 1st. A big gash between the main part of the embassy and one of the wings. Strangely enough, the roof, for the most part, was intact. He remembered something about its being reinforced to handle all the communications gear they'd put up there. As the dust settled, the 1st of the survivors began to crawl out of the building. Hurley was still holding on to hope at that point. It would be 2 full days before they grasped the extent of the damage. By then, the hope that Hurley had felt in those moments after watching the 1st survivor come out of the building was entirely gone, along with one of his best friends, Irene Kennedy's father, and 62 others. As was standard for the Lebanese Civil War, the locals took the brunt of the blast, but in terms of American personnel, the CIA took the heaviest toll. 8 agency employees were killed, and the Near East section was decimated. Stansfield had been Associate Deputy Director of Operations at the time, and he had rushed over to assess the damage. The guilt Hurley felt was overwhelming. He tried to resign, but Stansfield would hear none of it. He didn't care that Hurley had missed a 1 o'clock meeting at the embassy. There was some speculation about that. Was Islamic Jihad lucky in their timing, or did they have inside information that Langley's top people would be meeting at that time? And if so, some had spoken out loud that it was very convenient that Hurley missed the meeting. Hurley was placed under a microscope by a few higher-ups, but Stansfield covered for him. His operative was meeting with Petrosyan, the Armenian, and the meeting had gone longer than anticipated. That was as much as anyone needed to know. The fact that he was in bed with two hookers while the van crashed through the gate was inconsequential. They had already lost enough good people. They didn't need to lose another because of his vices. Vices that Stansfield was well aware of. Hurley knew Stansfield was right, but that didn't mean he could simply ignore what had happened. He was an operational wreck for those next few months. Stansfield received a report that Muslim men were turning up dead in areas of the city that were known to be relatively peaceful, completely randomly and at all hours of the day. One man was shot while reading the paper on his small terrace. Another was strangled in the bathroom of a public restroom. Another killed leaving a nightclub. All three men had loose connections to Islamic Jihad. Stansfield called Hurley back to D.C. to ask him if he knew anything about the murders. And to his astonishment, Hurley admitted to the killings. Stansfield could not allow one of his oldest friends and best operatives to go running off half-cocked, killing whomever he wanted, even if the targets were somewhat legitimate. As Hurley had pointed out, Islamic Jihad had declared war on the United States. He was simply obliging them by participating in the war. There was a bit of logic in his thinking, but Langley couldn't afford any more scrapes with the press and the politicians at the moment. The solution was easy. Things were heating up along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, and Hurley knew the Russians better than anyone. So Stansfield shipped him off to Peshawar to help train and equip the Mujahideen. And now, almost 10 years later, here he was, full circle, right back in this stew of religious fascists who all fervently believed they, and they alone, knew what God wanted. Hurley had been trying to warn Langley for years that these Islamic whack jobs were the next big problem. He'd seen both fronts up close, Beirut and Afghanistan, and the Afghanis made these guys look like pikers. Any culture that swaddles its women from head to toe and refuses a drop of booze while exporting opium around the globe is seriously screwed up. Another of Hurley's rules was to be extremely distrustful of anyone who didn't drink. Afghanistan was an entire society that didn't drink, and it scared the piss out of him. Hurley took a pull from the bottle and shook out another cigarette. He lit it, blew the smoke up into the ocean breeze, and thought about tomorrow. The safe house should be set up and equipped by then, and the backup would be ready by early afternoon. He'd have to see what kind of info the agency guy had, and if it wasn't enough, he'd go pay Petrosyan a call. Hurley had heard he owned more than 2,000 apartment units in the neighborhood. That would generate a lot of income. But a guy like Petrosyan could always use more money, and that was one thing that Hurley finally had a lot of. What he didn't have was time. If they were going to save the schnoz, they would have to work fast. Sometimes working fast could be used to your advantage, but you had to mix it up, and they'd been moving at a pretty good clip for about a week. Sharif, Dorfman, and by now Ismail, they might as well stay on the attack for a few more days. Hurley looked at the bottle of Tennessee whiskey and wondered if he'd come back to Beirut to die. All the times he'd cheated death, all the men he'd killed over the years, all the gods, real or imagined, that he'd pissed off. If it was anyone's time, it should be his. Looking skyward, he said, "Don't piss off the gods." He poured some of the whiskey down his gullet and smiled. If it was his time, so be it. Chapter 47. Martyrs Square, Beirut. Sundown was shortly after 5 in the evening, and sunrise shortly after 6 in the morning. With limited power in the building and no curtains on the windows, there wasn't much to do after sundown, so Syed had gone to bed early. Loyal Samir had scrounged up a mattress and a lantern and set up a room for him on the 5th floor, away from all of the men and most of the noise. He checked on the 2 prisoners briefly to make sure they were following his orders. The businessman was faring much better than the spy. Syed had brought a doctor in to take a look at Cummins, and the prognosis wasn't good. Due to the beatings, poor diet, and unsanitary conditions, the doctor feared he was suffering from liver failure. The news upset Syed. He had been warning the guards for several weeks to lay off the prisoners. But they somehow couldn't get it through their thick heads that the two men were worthless to them if they were dead. Add to that the stress of the missing money, and Ivanov coming to town, and it was enough to make Syed's temper flare out of control. He gathered the men in the basement and told them he would execute the next man who dared lay a hand on either prisoner. He caught one of the men rolling his eyes at the order, and before the imbecile knew it, Syed had the muzzle of his Markov pistol pressed firmly against his forehead. The others finally got the point. Syed went to bed wondering if they would rebel or follow his orders. It was just another thing to add to his general discomfort. He did not sleep well. His dreams, vivid and bizarre, taunted and tortured him. He was running. He must have been on the beach because no matter how fast he told himself to run, his legs plodded along as if they were stuck in deep sand. There was a dense fog, so thick that he could see no farther than the end of his hand. Jets were overhead, screeching and dropping deafening bombs in the distance. Bright flashes erupted through the marine layer, the noises of the big bombs muted by the moisture in the air. Why was he running toward the bombs? What was he running from? He woke up with a start, his heart pounding out of his chest, covered in sweat. Syed looked around the office where he'd decided to spend the night. A soft moonlight spilled in from the blown-out window. There was a pile of garbage in the corner, where Samir had swept the glass and debris. Scavengers had taken everything. The furniture, even the carpeting, had been pulled up, leaving only the bare concrete floor and the dried glue that had been used to hold the carpeting down. The whole thing was depressing. The geniuses in Damascus should all be forced to live like this for a night. Syed decided to get some air. He pulled on his shirt, but didn't bother to button it up. He climbed two flights to the roof, and with a murmur greeted the two men standing watch. All was quiet across the street. He lit a cigarette and wondered what Ivanov was up to. The man was always plotting. Given the choice between making a fortune the honest way and stealing it from someone, he was convinced Ivanov would prefer to steal it. He was a thief at heart. It was in no way a stretch to think of him plotting to kill Sharif. And then, with the Turk out of the way, killing Dorfman and taking everything for himself. Syed sighed. He wished he could skip ahead a day or two, be done with this mess and go back to Damascus for a few weeks. His two girls were grown and married, and had very little to do with him, and that was fine. He didn't particularly care for their husbands. Beyond that, he had never been around when they were growing up, so there was no real connection. His wife, they barely spoke. The women in life weren't the draw. Civilization was the draw. Running water and functioning toilets and sleeping in a clean bed without fear of 2,000 pounds of steel and high explosives being dropped on your head, that's what he needed. A VCR and a stack of movies and some sleep. He needed to recharge. If he could run, he would. Walk out of this hellhole of a city and leave it all behind. He'd considered it many times as his pot of money grew with Herr Dorfman. Another year or two and he would have made it. He could have gone back to Damascus, retired, and used the money he had stashed away in Switzerland to invest in opportunities as Beirut stabilized. He could have lived like a wealthy sheik. All of those years of hard work gone in an instant. It was almost impossible to bear. He finished his cigarette and looked at the stars. He didn't like having to stay in one place like this, especially a place so primitive. The food was horrid and infrequent. The conditions ripe for illness, and he couldn't sleep. And if he couldn't sleep, he would make mistakes. Mistakes were not something he could afford these next few days. He didn't want to go back to the depressing room with the soiled mattress, but he had to, at least to close his eyes and rest. Syed plodded down the steps and into the dark room. He took his shirt off, setting it on the floor, and then lay back down on the dirty mattress, trying to ignore the stench. The crux of the problem was the money, and it was a bigger problem than any of them realized. They were all lamenting their loss of personal wealth, but the dire situation lay in their inability to pay their people. There were a few mentally unstable militants who would work for free, but the bulk of the foot soldiers would walk away. They were paid in cash every week, and payday was Thursday. They would be able to scrape together enough to get through this week, but then they would be bankrupt. The following week, they have to pay their monthly bribes to the police, politicians, bureaucrats, and spies in the other camps. There would be hundreds, if not thousands, of hands extended, waiting for the money, and behind them, families, waiting to put food on the table. If they did not rectify this situation quickly, it could be a major disaster. The Maronites and the other factions would swoop in and pick up territory it had taken them years and thousands of men to gain. Everything they had worked for would unravel. He would have to tell Damascus and, of course, leave his personal loss out of it. They were likely to punish him by banishing him to Yarmouk, the bleak Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Damascus that was teeming with the pushy tribe in search of a permanent home. He heard footsteps down the hall, and then some voices. They sounded as if they were going from room to room. Looking toward the open doorway, he saw the beam of a flashlight. Syed grabbed his pistol and sat up. "He's up here somewhere," he heard a voice in the hallway say. "Who is it?" Syed asked. "It's me. I've been looking all over for you." Syed recognized Radi's voice and lowered his gun. "I'm in here." Radi appeared in the doorway. Three other men were behind him. "Asaf, you are not going to believe the news I bring you." Radi clapped his hands together. Syed looked for his watch but couldn't find it. "What time is it?" "Nearly 2 in the morning. You must get up. I have amazing news." Syed sighed. He half rolled off the mattress, looking for his watch. He found it, strapped it on, and then grabbed his shirt. "It better be good. I need some sleep." "You will not be disappointed." Syed felt like crap. He needed water, and then coffee, and then some food, in that order, and then maybe he could think clearly. He motioned for Radi to get on with the story. Radi told his men to leave, and in a hushed voice said, "Do you remember an American who went by the name Bill Sherman?" Did he remember him? The man had purportedly killed Syed's predecessor while he was enjoying his breakfast one spring morning. "Of course. My spy is at the airport. One of them says he saw Sherman tonight."
"At the airport?"
"Yes. He came in on a flight from Paris, along with another man." Syed was dubious. There had been rumors here and there that Sherman had been back to the city. In fact, any time someone met his end at the hands of an assassin, Sherman's name somehow became attached. "How can you be so sure? It has been many years since anyone has seen him."
"My man says he has aged. His hair has gone gray, but the eyes..."
Radi pointed to his own.
"He said they are those same eyes, eyes of the devil. He said he remembers him as a very nasty man with many vices."
Syed's lips felt unusually parched. He found the jug of water that Samir had left in the corner and took a drink. Why would the Americans send Sherman to Beirut after all these years? The most obvious answer was in the basement of this very building. They wanted their agent back. But why send an assassin like Sherman? The man was a harbinger of death, not a negotiator. Turning back to Radi, he asked, "Did your spy happen to know where he was headed?" With a self-satisfied grin, Radi said,
"I put out the word yesterday after our meeting. I told everyone to be on the lookout for anything suspicious. My people know how to do their jobs. They followed him and the other man to the Intercontinental."
"And?"
"They had a drink at the bar, and he bought a bottle of Jack Daniels from the bartender and then got into a cab, one of ours. He had the cabbie drop him off in front of a hotel on Daoura. After the cabbie was gone, they walked 3 blocks to a different hotel."
"Which one?"
"The Mar Yusuf Inn."
"And he is there? Right now?"
"Yes. They got 2 rooms for one night. I just spoke to the manager. They are still there."
"Are you sure?" Syed asked skeptically. "The Bill Sherman, I remember, would never allow himself to be followed."
"My men are good. We have trained them to use radios. They have a system set up at the airport. When they see someone who might be a fat target, they follow him and pass the word to me. We then swoop in and grab them. I have men heading to the area now. There's only one problem."
"What?"
"The hotel is in Burj Hamoud."
Syed needed to wake up. Normally, he would never ask such a stupid question. The Sherman he remembered was tight with the Armenians. This would have to be handled delicately. "If we get in a gun battle in Burj Hamoud, we might not make it out alive."
Radi did not disagree. "We can wait and follow him. If he leaves the Burj, we can grab him."
They'd been lucky enough to stumble across him. That luck would not hold with a man like Sherman. He would see them sooner rather than later. And then he would kill whoever it was who was watching him and disappear. "Tell your men to hold." Roddy seemed relieved. "And they might. The chief of police owes me a favor. They can operate in Burj Hamoud without too much trouble." This time Roddy shook his head. "I'm not so sure." "Normally you would be correct. But there are some things that you are unaware of. Some influential Armenians owe the chief a few favors. As long as we aren't going in to take one of their own, we will be fine."
"If a single shot is fired..."
Roddy winced at the thought. Syed finished it for him. "The entire neighborhood could erupt." Such was the reality of Beirut. The city was always one gun battle away from plunging back into chaos and civil war. Chapter 48. When he hit the midway point of the last run of stairs that led to the small lobby, Hurley noticed the man sitting in the chair with his back to the door. It was probably nothing, but then again, Hurley had survived all these years by noticing the little things. If enough of them piled up, they usually led to trouble. There was a couch and three chairs. The man was in the chair the farthest to Hurley's left, the same seat he would have chosen if he was to keep an eye on any guests coming down. Hurley watched him intently as he crossed the red-tiled floor. The man slowly closed his eyes and went back to dozing. Rather than head straight out, Hurley stopped at the desk. No one was there. He looked through the open door of the small office and couldn't see anyone, but could hear a TV. Looking back over his shoulder, he checked to make sure the fat man in the chair was still in his position. He had his eyes closed again and appeared to be dozing. Hurley checked him off his list. The payphone was behind the man in a quaint claustrophobic alcove. Rather than use it, Hurley decided to head outside and take in the lay of the land. When he reached the front door, he paused to see if there were any goons loitering. If there were, he would head back up to the room, grab Richards, and they would head to the roof. They could make it two buildings in either direction by hopping from one roof to the next, and then use any of the adjoining apartment buildings to make their escape. The sidewalk in front of the hotel was empty, so he stepped outside, tapped out a Camel, and fired it up. He casually looked up and down the block. He counted eight cars that he had seen the night before, and one new one, and it was only a small two-door hatchback. Nothing to be alarmed about. Right or left? It was funny how often that's what it came down to, a flip of the coin. He chose left. It was slightly uphill, not that it mattered, but he remembered seeing a small market in that direction the night before, and it had a payphone out front. He flipped the butt of his heater into the street to join the menagerie of discarded brands and started moving. It was before eight, and the street wasn't busy. It was empty, in fact. He saw two cars drive through the next intersection, moving from right to left, and then a man with a briefcase hustled across the street. Hurley couldn't remember if it was normal or abnormal for a city like Beirut to be so slow at this time. Every city had a different pulse. Some were bustling by seven, but most Mediterranean cities were a little slower paced, especially one that had endured as much trauma as this one. There was a boy standing in front of the market. Hurley guessed him to be about eight. As Hurley approached, the boy held out a paper and started giving him his pitch. Hurley smiled at him. He didn't care where he was. You had to admire a kid who got his ass out of bed to sell something. He reached into his pocket to grab some money, and right about the time he had a firm grip on his wallet, alarm bells started going off. There was movement to his left from the market, two or three car engines turned over, and then there were footfalls. Hurley looked left, then right, and then noticed that the cute little kid was backpedaling to get out of the way. Two men came out of the supermarket, big, burly guys in uniforms, who stopped just out of his reach. Car tires were now squealing, and engines were roaring as vehicles closed in from three directions. Hurley turned with the idea of running back toward the hotel, but there were two more men hoofing it up the sidewalk. One of them had a big German shepherd on a leash. That's new, he thought, never having seen a police dog in the city. In less than 5 seconds, he was surrounded by 10 men and three sedans. Six of the men were wearing police uniforms, and four were in civilian attire. The civilians had pistols drawn. They could be either part of a militia, or detectives, or worse, Syrian intelligence officers. The uniformed police were wielding wooden truncheons.
Interesting, Hurley thought to himself.
Not a single one of them attempted to lay a hand on him. Hurley calculated the odds while he slowly reached for his cigarettes. Even if he had had a gun, he wasn't sure he would have gotten himself out of this jam. They all looked nervous, which in itself told him something. Someone had prepped these guys, told them to keep their distance, which was not standard operating procedure in this part of the world. Normally, it was club first and ask questions later. Hurley lit his cigarette with the steady hand of a brain surgeon. He greeted the men in Arabic and asked, "What seems to be the problem?" "Good morning," announced a smiling man in a three-piece suit who appeared just beyond the phalanx of men. "We have been waiting for you, Mr. Sherman." He glanced ever so slightly at the two men behind Hurley and gave them a nod. Hurley turned and blocked the first blow with his left hand, wrist to wrist, and then delivered a palm strike to the man's nose. He ripped the truncheon from the man's hand and ducked just in time to miss the blow from his partner. The man was out of position from swinging so hard and had left his ribs exposed, so Hurley rammed him with the truncheon and sent him to the ground. Just as he turned to face the others, he was cracked across the head and then the back. He dropped to one knee and then to the ground as the batons and feet came crashing down. As they took the fight out of him, Hurley lay bleeding and hoping that Richards had enough time to run. Chapter 49 Rapp rocked the clutch of the little silver Renault Clio and closed the gap between himself and the next car waiting to get through the checkpoint to Beirut proper. It was his third checkpoint since the Syrian border. The little 1.2-liter engine was about as big as the one on his dad's old John Deere riding mower. If he had to run from the authorities, it would be a very short chase. He'd been in line now for about 15 minutes, inching his way forward a few feet at a time. The car didn't have any air conditioning, so he had the windows rolled down. Rapp slapped his hands on the steering wheel to the beat of some atrocious techno music that he'd picked up at the airport. The title of the album was Euro Trash, and he agreed. He would have preferred a little U2 or maybe some Bob Seger, but the idea here was to make them think he was French, not some American assassin on safari. Third in line now, he leaned out the window to get a better look at the teenager holding the AK-47 assault rifle. Rapp had no idea which faction he belonged to, but the kid seemed calm enough. The first checkpoints were manned by the Syrian army, and then as he neared the city, the militias were in charge. He'd found a payphone at a gas station along the way and called in to check on things. The automated voice told him his room was ready and gave him the address and the location. Rapp wrote it down, memorized it while on the road, then crumpled it up and threw it out the window. The file told him to expect 4 checkpoints, counting the border. Each one would cost him between $5 and $20. So far, whoever had put it together was right on the mark. The line snaked ahead and Rapp yawned. It was finally catching up with him. After sinking a hollow-tipped parabellum into Ismail's head, Rapp had steadily retreated, keeping his gun leveled at the woman, who was temporarily frozen with shock. Rapp wasn't going to shoot her and wasn't worried that she would shoot him. He kept his weapon raised to conceal his face and to deter her from looking too closely at him. People in general did not like to look down the barrel of a loaded gun. When the woman finally glanced down at the man who had threatened her life only moments before, Rapp turned and ran. He didn't turn the corner because he didn't want to head back down the street where Ismail had just fired the Uzi. Half the block was likely to be looking out their windows, and a few of them would be on the phone with the police. So he ran straight, at an all-out sprint for 2 blocks, the gun at his side. Then he took a hard right turn and stopped. His breathing was heavy but under control. He holstered the pistol while he looked for a place to reverse his jacket. 20 feet ahead on his right there was a stoop that would offer some concealment. Rapp ducked into the shadows, tore off his overcoat and turned it inside out. He tossed the clear black-rimmed glasses to the ground and mussed up his slicked back hair before emerging from the shadows wearing a khaki trench coat. He headed back to the corner he'd just rounded. The distinctly European police klaxon could be heard screeching in the distance. Rapp calmly crossed the street, looking to his left. He could just barely make out the woman. She had been joined by 3 or 4 people. Rapp acted as if he didn't notice. After he cleared the intersection, he picked up the pace, but not so much as to draw attention. He looked like a man out for a brisk walk. The Rhone was now only a block and a half in front of him. With each step, the sirens grew in force, but Rapp wasn't worried. They would go to the body first, and then they would check the damage caused by the Libyan's Uzi, and then they would begin to look for a suspect. Rapp reached the river, which at this point was fairly wide. He turned right, and after looking up and down the block to make sure no one was watching, he casually slid his left hand between the folds of his jacket and grabbed the Beretta he'd used to kill Ismail. Rapp waited until he was in the shadows between two streetlights and then drew the gun. He flipped it casually a good 20 feet into the ice-cold water and kept moving. A block after that, he disposed of the second gun, then had to make his first big decision. Just on the other side of the river, 1 mile away, was Geneva International Airport. If he hustled, he might be able to catch the last flight out to Paris. Airports made him nervous, though. There were always cameras and police, and if you were going to get on a plane, you had to buy a ticket and show a passport, and that left a trail. His legends were to be cultivated and protected, not used for convenience' sake. So he turned back with the rental car and rehearsed what he would tell the police if they stopped him. Fortunately, the story was never needed. Police were flooding the area, but they were still headed to the crime scene. On his way back, he didn't see a single police car heading out to look for suspects. When he climbed behind the wheel of the rental car, he checked his stopwatch. 4 minutes and 37 seconds had elapsed since he'd taken refuge behind the mailbox. Not bad. Once behind the wheel, he had a lot of options. The primary plan was to cross the border into France and then drive to Lyon, but he was too pumped up, and with the border crossing so close, they might be looking for a man of his general description. Again, there was no longer any hard evidence that could tie him to Ismail's death, but why push it? Rapp wasn't sure he could calm his nerves through the border crossing. The reality of what he'd just been through was setting in. There was no queasiness or feeling of nausea. He was simply pumped. The feeling very similar to the way he felt after scoring a game-winning goal. But better. He cranked the music and headed back for Zurich. Greta was on his mind, but there wouldn't be time. He'd have to grab the first flight to Paris or Istanbul, and then on to Damascus. He made it to Zurich just before 4, parked in the rental car lot, and tried to grab a few hours of sleep before things opened at 6. It didn't work, though, and he sat there with his seat reclined, playing it over and over in his head, until he had analyzed every second of what had happened with Ismail. Each mistake was noted and alternatives explored, but as his old high school coach liked to say, a win is a win. It doesn't matter how ugly it is. Strip it all down, and that's what it was. Rapp won, and Ismail lost. As the sun started to rise, Rapp looked out from the concrete parking structure and realized that one day he might be in Ismail's shoes. He'd pretty much spent the rest of the morning thinking of ways to prevent himself from ending up with a fate similar to that of the Libyan intelligence officer. From Zurich to Istanbul and then Damascus, and all the way down this hot, dusty road to Beirut, he played a game of chess with himself. What should Ismail have done, and how should he have reacted if Ismail had done something different? Exhaustion was finally catching up. Rapp let out a long yawn, and then the kid motioned him forward. Rapp greeted the kid in French. He couldn't have been more than 16. Rapp smiled while he tapped out the techno beat and chomped on his gum. "What is your purpose?" the kid asked, with a lack of enthusiasm you'd expect from someone who was expected to stand in the sun all day, sucking on emissions and asking the same question over and over. "Business? What kind of business?" "Software." The kid shook his head. "What's that?" "Computer stuff." Rapp reached over and picked up the flashy color brochure they'd ordered from a French company. He showed the kid, who was by now bored with their conversation. "I like your music."
"Really?"
Rapp said, surprised. "Are you here every day?" The kid nodded. Rapp looked over at the kid's dusty boombox, and then reached over and ejected the tape. He slid it into the case and said, "I've been listening to it for a week straight. Knock yourself out. I'll pick it up when I drive back out in a few days." The kid was excited and lowered his rifle. "Thanks. For you, half price today." He flashed Rapp 5 fingers. Rapp paid him, smiled, slipped the little car back into gear, and drove away. It took him another 20 minutes to find the safe house. Based on the stories he had heard from Hurley, he was surprised that during that time he didn't run into any more armed men. As per his training, he did a normal drive-by and barely glanced at the building. All he wanted to do was go to sleep, but it had been drilled into him that these were the precautions that would save his life. So he continued past and then circled back, checking the next block in each direction. It was a 5-story apartment building among 4-, 5-, and 6-story apartment buildings. Rapp was too tired to care if it had any architectural characteristics beyond a front and back door. He parked the car, grabbed his bag, and entered the building. He didn't have a gun on him, at least not yet, so there was pretty much only one thing to do: climb the stairs. If it was a trap, he'd have to throw his bag at them and lie down and take a nap. No one was waiting for him when he got to the 5th floor. There were 3 doors on the left and 3 on the right. They had the 2 on the right toward the back, or so he thought. After checking above each door, he came up empty, so he checked the ones across the hall and found 2 keys. That was when he remembered he was supposed to enter from the back of the building. That snapped him out of it a bit. That, and the lesson that he might be Ismail someday. He told himself to slow down and stop rushing things. He checked his watch. It was 2:11 in the afternoon. He hadn't slept in more than a day, and the day before that only a few hours. He opened the door and closed and locked it behind him. He could barely keep his eyes open, but he still dug out the doorstop and wedged it under the door. Not bothering to check the rest of the place, he went into the bedroom and opened the closet. There, on the floor, was a suitcase that looked a lot like the one from Istanbul. Rapp placed it on the bed, opened it, and found 3 Beretta 92Fs with silencers and extra magazines. It was the same suitcase. Rapp loaded one of the guns and put the suitcase away. With his last bit of strength, he stripped down to his boxers and climbed under the covers of the twin bed. He shoved the pistol under the pillow and wondered who the person was who went from city to city dropping off their tools of the trade. Would he ever get the chance to meet this mystery man or woman? Probably not. As Hurley liked to say, they were on a need-to-know basis, and there wasn't a lot they needed to know. Rapp began to drift off to sleep, even though he knew that Hurley and Richards would probably be there in a minute. He figured any sleep was better than none. Chapter 50. The bag they'd placed over his head offered a mix of putrid smells. Feces, vomit, snot, and blood all mixed together with the sweat of all the men who had worn it before him. And it wasn't the perspiration of exertion. It was the ripe sweat of fear and all-out assault on his olfactory system, designed to make him pliable to whoever it was who would walk through the door and begin asking questions. Hurley had no idea where he was, other than the fact that he was in a basement. He'd felt the stairs as they dragged him from the trunk of a car and into the building. It was the 2nd car he'd been in that morning. In the midst of his pummeling by the police, he blurted out the only name that he thought might help.
Levon Petrosian! I am a friend of Petrosian!
The clubbing and kicking stopped almost immediately, and then one of the men asked him what he'd said. Hurley could tell it was the portly one in a 3-piece suit, even though he couldn't see him. The man ordered him cuffed and placed in the back seat of one of the cars. They weren't gentle, but Hurley didn't expect them to be, so it wasn't too bad. That was when they placed the 1st hood on his head. It wasn't too bad, really. It could have used a good cleaning, but at least it didn't smell like a bowl of shit. He marked the time in the back of the car, counting the seconds and trying to make sense of the noises beyond the glass windows. The metal cuffs were biting into his skin. He twisted his wrists around and tried to see if he could get out of them, but it was no use. 27 seconds later, the car doors opened. Hurley couldn't be sure, but he thought 2 men got in the front seat, and 1 man joined him in the back. He felt something hard jab into his ribs.
"Don't move, or I will kill you."
Hurley couldn't be sure if the object at his side was a gun or a truncheon.
"Fuck you!"
The object was jabbed even harder into his side.
"You shouldn't talk to a policeman like that."
The voice came from the front seat. It was the older Pudgeball.
"Policeman," Hurley said with open disdain, "if you're cops,
What am I being arrested for?
For striking a police officer. One of my men has a broken nose.
You mean the one who was going to crack me over the back of the head with his stick? I have a great idea. Don't bullshit me, and I won't bullshit you.
Striking a police officer is a very serious matter.
Yeah, so is kidnapping. So why don't you just pull over and let me go, and I'll make sure no one puts a price on your head.
Are you threatening us?
Just telling you the truth. I make it a habit not to kill cops. That is, unless they're corrupt.
Hurley doubled over as the man next to him delivered a stinging blow with whatever it was that he was holding.
Hurley recovered and said, I can't wait to tell Petrosian about this. The first thing I'm going to do...
Hurley turned to his right as if he could actually see the man next to him,
is take that stick of yours and shove it up your ass, although you'd probably like that, wouldn't you?
Hurley expected it this time and folded his arms up quickly, locking the object between his right biceps and forearm. Then he reeled his head back and smashed it in the general direction of the other man's head. They hit forehead to forehead like two pool balls. A loud, resounding crack. Despite the pain that Hurley felt, he started laughing wildly and kicking and thrashing. That was when they decided to pull over and put him in the trunk. Not long after that, maybe 10 minutes, they stopped, pulled him out of the trunk, and stripped him down to his birthday suit. Hurley endured this part without comment. He had a sinking feeling where this was all headed, and it was bleak, to say the least. He held out hope, though, that Richards had been able to get away. They wasted no time tossing him into the trunk of a second car and speeding off. It was a bumpy ride, and it must have been an older car because the fumes grew so strong that Hurley started to think he would suffocate. It occurred to him that that might be the best possible outcome. Fall asleep and die from carbon monoxide poisoning. He could skip all of the degradation and take his secrets with him. Unfortunately, he had survived, and they had dragged him into this dank basement that smelled like an outhouse. They'd switched out the hood that the police had used and put this disgusting burlap bag on his head. Hurley took in shallow breaths through his mouth and focused his mind. Throwing up under this thing would be extremely unpleasant. But then again, there was a really good chance that he was about to endure the most repugnant degradation the mind could imagine, so why worry? The mind, Hurley knew, could only take so much before it simply opened up and let the secrets spill out. They said everyone eventually broke. But Hurley didn't think of himself as everyone. He was a mean, nasty man who might have lost a step, but he was still very much in control of his mind. Under the smelly hood, he smiled at the challenge ahead of him. He went through the long, nasty list of the things they would do to him. He committed himself to fighting them every step of the way. And if he was lucky, they'd either intentionally or accidentally kill him. And that was a victory he would take in a heartbeat. Hurley sat there for at least an hour. He was bored, because he knew what they were doing, and he'd just as soon get on with it. Isolation was a standard interrogation torture technique. And while it worked on most people, it was useless on Hurley because of the simple fact that he really didn't like people all that much. There were a few here and there that he'd met over the years who could hold his interest, but most others were either boring or irritating. There were noises on the other side of the door. Footsteps, some talking, but nothing he could make out, and then the door opened. Hurley tried to count the different steps. His best guess was 3 or 4 men. They spread out around him. Someone approached him from behind, and Hurley resisted the impulse to flinch. The man grabbed the burlap bag and yanked it from his head. Hurley blinked several times and took a look around the room. An industrial lamp hung from the ceiling, a brown extension cord snaking its way to the door. Hurley looked at the 3 men he could see. 2 were familiar.
"Gentlemen, there must be some misunderstanding here," Hurley announced in an easy tone. "I thought hostilities in Beirut were over."
The 2 men in front of Hurley shared a brief smile. The older one said,
"Mr. Sherman, I have been looking forward to this for some time."
"So have I, Syed."
"So you know who I am?" Syed asked with a raised eyebrow.
"I sure do. You're the GSD goon here in Beirut.
And you, Mr. Sherman, are a CIA assassin."
Hurley looked as if he had to think about that for a second, and then he nodded and said,
"That would be correct. I kill people like you for a living. In fact, I killed your boss, Hisham."
Syed nodded. This was going to be very interesting.
It really was a shame that you weren't at the embassy that afternoon. We planned the entire operation, with the hope that you would be there.
Yeah, it was a real shame, although I've tried to make up for it over the years by killing as many of you assholes as I can.
Syed gave him an affable smile. It looks like your killing days have come to an end.
Possibly.
Hurley surveyed the dank room.
Things don't look so good, but I'm always up for a challenge.
This is a challenge you will not win, and you know that.
I'm afraid I don't. You see, I'm a fucked-up guy. I'm not okay in the head, and I pretty much hate you limp dicks more than I love life, so this is going to be a tough one.
Really, Mr. Sherman, your false bravado is so American, so Hollywood. Hurley winced at the word Hollywood, as if it pained him to be associated with the town.
No false bravado here, Syed. I am going to fuck with you until I take my last breath. I'm going to feed you so much disinformation, you won't know what to believe. You'll be killing your own people before it's all over. You won't sleep at night, and when you do, you'll be dreaming of traitors around every corner, spies in your own camp. This is going to be a blast.
Really?
Yep.
Hurley gave him a nod to confirm his conviction.
The two of us are going to take a little trip into the bowels of my sick mind, and trust me, you won't make it out unscathed.
Ha! Syed laughed. This was a first. Fine. I think we should begin our journey, don't you?
Absolutely. The sooner the better. That's my motto.
Why have you decided to come back to Beirut after all these years?
You know why I'm here.
Let's not assume I know your motives. Hurley smiled.
You have something I want.
And what would that be? Hurley had thought about this while he had sat under the putrid hood. Ivanov was due to show up the day after tomorrow, and he would be desperate. They were all desperate because Hurley himself had drained their little secret bank accounts. He just hoped they hadn't gotten their hands on Richards, and if they had, that he would be smart enough to leave Hamburg out of his interrogation. He needed to make this seem to be about exactly what it was without the money coming up.
I am here to negotiate the release of John Cummins.
And why would I give him to you? Hurley tilted his head back and looked up at the ceiling.
Well, let's think about that. If you give him back to me, I won't kill you.
This elicited laughter from all, including Hurley. Syed stopped laughing abruptly and snapped his fingers. He looked at one of his men and pointed at the door. The men left and came back a few seconds later, wheeling the small stainless steel cart. Syed took it from him and positioned it next to the subject. He smiled at Hurley and picked up the pliers, opening and closing them.
Manicure?
Hurley asked. I like to call it 20 questions.
You're so clever, Syed,
Hurley said, his voice dripping with mock admiration.
Kind of like a game show. I can't wait to get started.
Good. Let's start with your real name.
Jack Mehoff,
Hurley offered, straight-faced. Jack Mehoff? Syed repeated. That is your real name?
Of course it isn't, you fucking moron. Jack Mehoff. Jack Mehoff. Come on, let's go. Off with the first fingernail. You win, I lose. Let's go.
Syed searched the subject's face for a sign of stress. He had never had a prisoner ask to have his fingernail torn off. His demeanor would change in a second, though. Syed chose the forefinger on the left hand and wedged the grip of the pliers in under the nail bed. Last chance. Your first name?
Don't change the rules on me. Very confusing for your subjects. You said 20 questions. I blew the first one. Come on, let's go,
Hurley said with a smile. Syed clamped down hard on the pliers and began to rock the nail back and forth.
Oh, yeah, Hurley announced. Let's get this party started.
Syed gave it one good yank and ripped the entire nail off.
Holy Mary, mother!
Hurley unleashed a string of swear words and then started laughing.
Damn, that stings! If that doesn't wake you up, nothing will. This is great!
His laughing grew to the point where he couldn't control it. He was shaking so hard, his eyes started to tear up.
Oh, I can't wait for the next one! This is fucking great!
Syed remained undeterred. Your name?
Bill Donovan.
Really?
Nope.
Really, Mr. Sherman, what is the harm in your telling us your first name?
Probably nothing at this point, but it's my name.